Today is December the 11th, 1972, a Monday morning. The following conversation is with Ed Morgan of the Domestic Council. The two people interviewing Mr. Morgan will be Jack Nesbitt and Terry Good.
About him or by him.
Yeah.
I'm sure we got a lot more than that.
Sure. For sure.
Well, whenever the official files end up downstairs, Ed, then we'll be able to go through those and really get a lot of information. And hopefully at some later date, be able to come back with you and sit down and have a real extensive in-depth interview. But at this point, as Jack says, it's very factual, and we try our utmost to avoid asking the questions that would require an opinion, evaluation, or appraisal on your part of anybody or anything, because obviously we'd be asking too much if we would ask those types of questions. Now, if we get just some basic information about it, now, fine.
Because in a regular full bore oral history program, the interviewee gets first crack at the transcript so that he can edit it or do whatever he wants with it, so that it then reflects what he really meant to say, and a voice just slips or. Right. Even things that he felt now he'd like to pull back on, because then the transcript becomes the research document at some point.
You joined the White House staff at the beginning of the administration.
Yep.
Your departure day will be December 31st?
Not necessarily. My departure day is whenever the Senate confirms me to the new job, so they don't convene until the 3rd of January, so I would hope it would be sometime thereafter, sooner after, as they can agree.
You've had, I think, at least several titles since you've been within the White House complex, because obviously you came on originally as part of the White House payroll, and
right.
With the creation of the Domestic Council, you switched over. Could you give us just very briefly what titles you had in both those situations?
Right. Well, I started as an advance man for the president. I mean, if you want to know who I am.
Fine.
And that was in my first campaign with the president in 1966 as an advance man, and was asked to join them in 68 and started doing that even prior to New Hampshire. Maintained a position of going out and doing advances at the same time practicing law up until the Republican convention, and then I went full time. After the election, I joined the White House staff as deputy counsel to the president, John Ehrlichman was the counsel. Subsequently, when the domestic counsel was created, I became deputy assistant to the president for domestic affairs. I'm sorry, that was prior to the creation of the Domestic Council. Ehrlichman got into domestic policy. He became assistant for domestic policy. I became one of the deputy assistants to the president for domestic policy, again a presidential commission. Then with the creation of the Domestic Council, I also became the assistant director of the Domestic Council. So I would differ only in that respect, say, from the John Evans or Lou Ingram, who were just that, just assistant directors. In 69, the president also appointed me to the Council of the Administrative Conference of the United States. And in 1970, appointed me vice chairman of the Administrative Council of the United States, which, as you're probably aware, deals primarily with recommendations and the application of the administrative process in the federal government. It's made up of both federal government people and private sector people, and they're mostly, I would say, 90% lawyers, dealing a great deal with the Administrative Procedure Act and its application. In 1971, with the departure of Bob Mardian from the Cabinet Committee on Education to go over to Internal Security and Justice, I also took on the duty, without compensation, of being the Executive Director of the Cabinet Committee on Education. I couldn't hold both positions, I shouldn't be paid for both. But I picked that up as an additional duty, so I ran the Cabinet Committee on Education, which dealt primarily with the Southern State Advisory Committees on Desegregation. I think that rounds out the titles. I'm also a hall monitor on alternate Thursdays.
Just for the second of the first
floor. Just for the first floor hall, yes.
And you're going to check all this just to be sub-cabinet?
Just to be sub-cabinet. Just to do something different.
Boy, I don't even know where to start here. What we generally like to do then is go back and
say, what did I do while I was here?
While you were in each one of these positions, and how much time you spent in each one, and the projects you worked on?
When I started out, when I first went on the payroll, we were at the Pierre Hotel in New York. I would say my first responsibilities as a lawyer for the president were with Bud Crowe to work on the conflict of interest problems of the incoming cabinet and sub-cabinet. We put together the book on conflicts of interest. It was distributed to cabinet members, interviewed all the cabinet nominees, and tried to get them firms in the Senate. And to a certain extent, did it with a sub-cabinet. we handled random, unassorted legal problems that came into the White House. Obviously, in the first days, they were, I suppose, somewhat catch-as-catch-can. Nonetheless, I got involved to a great extent that first year with exactly what you're doing now and recommending that you want to do what you're doing now, and that is the president's papers and the Nixon Library and the Nixon Foundation.
Your name's on a couple of the things that we've got in our files.
So for that first couple of months, I dealt a great deal with just getting the president's papers in order and getting them moved down here to the archives. It involved also the president's tax returns and a great deal of the president's legal situation as far as Florida, New York, San Clemente property, and things of that nature. and that occupied, I would say, considerable of my time the first couple of months here, those kinds of things.
Would that be also working with Frank DeMarco at the time?
Oh, yes. Did a great deal with Frank DeMarco, Herb Kalmbach, and Dick Ritzel of the old Nixon Mudge firm. Was the at that time more or less the trust lawyer, and his sidekick, his name escapes me. I've got it somewhere. It's Tanian was the other lawyer. In that particular loop, because that involved everything from stock and the property that we sold off in Florida, and those kinds of things. I'm sure the more complete records today would be in Ehrlichman's office, not mine. As Kalmbach was phased in and the New York firm out, was about the time also I started to move out of that business and into domestic policy. And I suppose my first cut into domestic policy was welfare reform. That was the days, of course, when we had Pat Moynihan here and Arthur Burns, and the development, the president was committed to reforming the welfare situation. He had a mountain of paperwork that had been developed both by HEW under Bob Finch, by the interim presidential task force under Dick Nathan, which had already reported it to Pierre when the group of Arthur Burns task forces reported in. And he had other separate recommendations from Burns, a whole system of recommendations from Moynihan, and a great deal of, I would say a great number of notebooks compiled. And it was getting to the point where there was comments on comments on comments. It was very hard to distill or look at from a president's standpoint as to just what the real alternatives were. He knew what he had in mind, but someone had to start sorting out and putting together what the real in-depth alternatives were that were in a system that you could look at and read without having to read thousands of pages of commentary. The upshot of that was the formation of the first White House working group that had ever been formed. And I was ran that for John Ehrlichman. The president really told Ehrlichman, put together a group. He asked Ehrlichman really to be the honest broker of all these different viewpoints and bring it together in some composite way that it could be understood. So with Ehrlichman in charge of welfare reform, I chaired the working group for John Ehrlichman, which included representatives of the agencies such as Dick Nathan from the Budget Bureau, Bob Patricelli from HEW, John Price from Moynihan's staff, Marty Anderson from Arthur Burns' staff, Jerry Rossow, Assistant Secretary of Labor, and a sort of backup personnel that they had. That was night and day work straight through until the president's first domestic policy speech in August of 70. So I would say probably from May or June when I first was getting familiar with it, and then certainly from the 4th of July until August, it was every day and every night with that working group putting together the details. And we had Pat Moynihan and I, for instance, went on a visit with Rockefeller, because we had all kinds of problems in terms of the small state, big state distribution. And what eventually came out of those meetings was what came to be known as the whole harmless clause. This is more detail than you want right now.
That's all right, we'll take it.
But that is what I was involved in the majority of the time. In those days, prior to the Domestic Council formation and prior to OMB, when it was the Budget Bureau, the Ehrlichman staff then had departmental liaison, so that you had particular departments from a domestic policy standpoint that you were responsible to and responsible for. I had HEW, the Labor Department, OEO, and the Veterans Administration. Or basically, I was as close to the Human Resources Division of the Budget Bureau as it could come. In other words, human people problems were mainly mine. Bud Krogh had crime and drugs and justice. John Whitaker, the environment. But he had departments like Interior, Agriculture, et cetera, which he'll tell you he was responsible for. So it was broken out that way. And Henry Cashin in those days was with us and had Transportation and HUD and a couple of others. So that was the departmental structure, and we had a departmental structure in those days. So that all of health and all of education and all of welfare were in theory my responsibility, not to plan their policy or run their departments, but I was their touchstone in for that particular secretary or undersecretary or assistant secretaries. Following welfare reform, up until up until the State of the Union of it's amazing how years get away from you, not just days. Up until the State of the Union that had the six great goals, was that 70, 71 or not six? I can't remember anymore. 71. I then chaired several working groups, domestic policy working groups. Elementary and secondary education, which resulted in a message and program to Congress. The higher education working group. There is an excellent paper that Checker Finn did when he was here that was just this, a history of how we put together the higher education package, which I can give to you, which I think you'll find invaluable. He'd leave that just for this reason. It had been a deal already cut between Moynihan and Ehrlichman and all that he could finish his PhD by doing something like that. And it seemed to me that if he did that, the archives and the president's papers ought not to lose the benefit of that having been done, so I know we haven't. And I also chaired the group that put together the emergencies, excuse me, just a second. And the other one that came to mind was the emergency strike legislation, which was denominated Emergency Transportation something Act. That, for instance, working group was Larry Silverman, Jim Lim, myself, and others. It had to do with the fact that we needed legislation that would provide alternatives to deal with these emergency strike situations where the time expires and the president, you know, has to act either drastically and the Congress refuses to act, to give the president more tools to deal with emergency strike situations. The question in those days was whether you included any more than the railroads in terms of the transportation industry. And that, I think, we have pretty good files on that you can look at and what the back and forth of all of that was and the net result. Following that, and those days of a series of working groups and domestic policy proposals that resulted in presidential messages and proposed legislation, which I could say was certainly the bulk of my work from welfare reform up until the time of the 1971 State of the Union. In 71, I took on a somewhat different assignment for Haldeman and Ehrlichman. Not so much dropping out of the domestic policy field, but getting a little more into the quote marketing field, which would drive everybody up a wall around here when I use that term. But basically, The president announced the six great goals of welfare reform, revenue sharing, government reorganization, etc. Most of which I've been involved with, like revenue sharing, not so much government reorganization. The question was, how did we orchestrate trying to get those programs not only through the Congress, but understood by the public? So I would say for 6 months, that's what I worked on. In a little different concept than we had had before, we came up with the project manager system. Fred Malik and I did some work on that. And so I really had a project manager for each of the six programs. And the idea was to coordinate and keep a coordinated effort moving on all six of these programs. It was not a question of PRing the hell out of them, but it was a question of trying to get not only the public to understand, but the interest groups to understand just what it was that we were proposing and were about, and the Congress to understand, and of course the net result being to get action and get them passed. That's an encapsulated view of what that was about, but that is what I did work on, I would say, full-time, 5 or 6 months.
Who were the other project managers, Ed, on this? I can recall Andy Rouse's name for one.
Andy Rouse had government reorganization. Jamie McLean had revenue sharing. Jim Cavanaugh, who's now assistant to Ken Cole, had health. I can see the fellow. He left the White House. He was Whitaker's assistant around the environment. He had been a White House fellow and stayed on under Whitaker. That'll come back.
Well, you've zeroed in enough on him, I'm
four.
Sure.
We can find him. Or Dana Mead, you know who he was. My two assistants to keep it running were Mead and John Evans in those days. But anyway, we can. That's just a factual question. We can run that with no difficulty at all.
The Pamphlet series. One of the things that emerges
That's right. The government reorganization committee and the revenue sharing committee and the governors, having the governors in here and getting Rockefeller to push for the revenue sharing effort. All of that was part of the operation I was trying to run.
That would have taken you within the complex through the congressional relations people, through Colson's.
Right. In fact, we had. In those days, we then had a coordinating meeting every morning at 8 o'clock. After the 7:30 meeting, we had a coordinating meeting that involved Colson, Timmons, Jeb Magruder, Klein Schaap, Dwight Chapin. And we've got the minutes of those meetings, so that'll simplify that part for you. About those days, people were starting to get a little upset that their kids were getting on buses to go to school, or it was contemplated that they were going to be. And the whole integration or school desegregation problem in the South was having its difficulties. The president formed a cabinet committee on education. It was headed by the vice president. It started. And Bob Mardian went from HEW over to this newly formed committee. Its executive director. It was made up of members of the cabinet. Schultz was the vice chairman. And in the opening days, Owen Lund Garment was very actively participating in it, and you'll find the records of that. In the early days, really all I was doing early was going to the meetings to tell them what the hell was going on. It's not a spy, I was just a monitor. A dutiful reporter. As it moved along, as things will happen, I started to get more and more involved in the particular problems, not so much the policy, but we were having just a whip stitch in time with some of the southern school districts. As a result, that first tough summer, even prior to Swan in April of 70 was the first real tough summer. I wound up monitoring for Ehrlichman and the president just how we were handling some of these things, because that was really the first summer and probably the only summer when there were whispers of federal troops and all that sort of thing that might happen in the South. The Justice Department had a command center, and really what I did was work directly with Terry Leonard and Stan Pottinger in that game, trying to keep people from losing their heads. As a result of either, question by doing it well, or just the fact that I did it, nobody else wanted to touch it, I bought myself a project for the rest of my time here. Eternally, then every summer.
I couldn't help but there was a school bus over there.
Yes. From my loyal and faithful Stan. After that summer, which we got through, came April of 71, and the Swan decision, which some people I'm sure don't even understand the date after having read it 100 times. I may be one of them. The president of the day asked that we look into this whole question of what might happen. And the summer of Swan, or 71, was then our second civil rights summer. And that that took all of my time, because the first big shot out of the game was the Austin case, which you'll recall we disavowed the HEW plan on appeal. And following Austin, was a series of this whole question of how the hell Swan was to be interpreted, and a great deal of disagreement as to just what Swan stood for and what it meant. Given that, and given the great difficulty in interpretation that the circuit courts were having with the Swan decision, applying differing standards to different cases and certainly differing standards in different circuit courts, it was leading to chaos in some places, and certainly disillusionment and the formation of parents groups and all kinds of problems that are considerable upset on the Hill. We started, even that summer, looking at what the possibilities would be for legislation, everything from a constitutional amendment to legislation to executive action to taking different postures in these cases in the courts via intervention, for instance. Coming out of late 71 and early this year was this review and instructions by the president to explore these alternatives. And the first public thing you see in 72 is the meeting the president had with the 6 senators to hear their viewpoint on just what was going on. And his instructions before leaving on the China-Moscow series of trips to have a first cut of some alternatives ready for him to look at when he came back. So working group oriented as I was from my years here, we did have a group put together. The president appointed a small cabinet group at that time of Schultz, Ehrlichman, Mitchell, and Richardson. Became the staff man for that. Just a sidebar there, that was during the Mitchell-Kleindienst affairs. So it was Mitchell in, Kleindienst hanging, then Kleindienst in, and Mitchell fading. So then the net result was Kleindienst was the member. But we went through that particular era at the same time. The staff group included Ken Dam, from assistant director of the OMB, because primarily he was highly relied upon by Schultz and was a constitutional lawyer, which he is. And Paul O'Neill from the budget, because of the whole question of whether or not we could take some of this Title I money that had never been doing what it was supposed to be doing, and the emergency school aid money, and see if there was not a way to infuse funds into these inferior schools to make them good schools, given the fact you couldn't bus everybody in the United States everywhere. As a practical matter, you just can't. That was one part of the program. Len Garment was actively involved in it, and there is a pretty good New York Times article by Bob Simple that documents how the whole moratorium question came up, although his leaving is that Garment and I were sitting in a dark bar by the White House, and although it's true. Isn't the best press in the world. But Garment and I basically talked in terms of a moratorium, and then the whole group began working, just what kind of a moratorium we could have. Coupled with that, it would take substantive legislation, because for the Congress under the 14th Amendment, Section 5 of the 14th Amendment, to impose limitations on constitutional rights, which it is empowered to do. They can't just do it in perpetuity, or that was certainly our judgment. But there would have to be a moratorium for a short time, would have to be coupled with what the substantive result would then be under congressional legislation. That was a time when I dealt with outside consultants. We got Charles Allen Wright, a constitutional lawyer from the University of Texas, Robert Bork, who was a great help when I was then going to be the Solicitor General, to help us on some of the constitutional questions, and used a Chicago law firm to view it from what I termed a trial standpoint. How would you try this case and win it? The upshot of that was a round of meetings with the President and then at Camp David, and finally the proposal of the Equal Educational Opportunities Act and the Student Transportation Limitation Act that were both presented to Congress. That took care of my time right up to and through that proposal and whatever it was. And my recollection is March or April of this year. And it was all the briefings and the congressional this and that, with that attached to it. Plus, of course, innumerable meetings with unhappy people on one side or the other. As the summer came on of this year, that's what I was doing. I got one particular project to work on that was never public. So I would imagine that in the oral history, someone else will tell you about that. And well, to that extent, you'll come back to me, right? Maybe if they don't, history misses another one. But I don't think it's my prerogative to discuss it. It's not that it's that super secret. It's not that I was sneaking under walls or anything.
No, but at this stage, we'd assume avoid those things, and then we're going to have problems with the tapes or anything else.
In fact, you may find somebody like an Ehrlichman or Holloman is going to mention two or three that just escaped me over the first 4 years. So up to this point, I haven't edited anything out that I've done. This one occurs to me that, you know, my name shows up at the convention in a couple of articles. But I assume somebody else will tell you to what extent, if any, I was involved in anything. After the convention, basically what I did up until now, or up until the election, rather, was try and keep the fires from igniting in the busing area. So I really did a lot of traveling to meet with dissident groups of people to keep them from throwing grenades or showing up here in Washington at the time we didn't need them here.
How about the crap in Richmond that they meet with you?
Yes, I met with them twice. Several trips to Detroit. Went around Michigan meeting with all those people. So I did some public speaking and some private meeting, basically surrounding that issue. Texas, other places, California, a couple.
Throughout your rundown, Ed, you've mentioned the minutes of this meeting will be quite clear and concise, and we'll explain this in detail. And the minutes of this meeting will explain this one. Is it reasonable to hope that your activities in these other areas that you've talked about are equally well documented?
Which other areas?
And some of these others, well, in fact, all of the areas that you've been involved in here that you've talked about. In one or two instances, you said, the meetings of this working group are written down. The minutes of this meeting are fairly well documented.
Yeah,
is it fair to say that your other activities are also well documented, either in your files or John Ehrlichman's files or...
I think the answer to that is yes. When I talked about minutes of meetings, obviously I would mean meetings that kept minutes. Working groups, working till 3 in the morning didn't necessarily, or I wouldn't presume to suggest, kept minutes of what they were doing. You didn't have time in those days to be taking down minutes. The one exception being the higher education thing, where Finn did exactly that. But on cabinet committee and committees of that kind, and meetings with the president, I know I'm up to date on, I've sent in all my meetings with the president. For your people. those are the kind of minutes I meant would make clear what happened or who was there, where I was searching for names as to who was on that particular committee would make clear.
In these working groups where perhaps were no minutes kept, would there be drafts of some of the thoughts and the ideas that were going into them that were discussed?
Right.
And final reports or recommendations or something of that nature. And would those in large part show your input into those, or would it be a case where this is the opinion of this working group and it wouldn't necessarily detail that your position on it was this and somebody else's position on it was this or anything of that nature?
That would vary. We we always took the position here that the working group was not in the business saying who on the working group's opinion was this, that, or the other thing, or who made specifically strong recommendations. But here are the alternatives, staffed out all the way to the bottom. And here are the implications and the ramifications of this choice. That gets very complicated, actually, in a welfare kind of thing, because you don't just take five choices and make one, and say, therefore, all of this happens. There are going to be some sub-choices that have to be made, and of course, the delegate business is to surface those that a president or an Ehrlichman has to focus on and has to make and give them enough to understand that there are a couple of sub-alternatives. You know, which way do you want those phased, and the rest will fall into place. Now, I'm not telling you anything you don't know, but there isn't going to be that kind of expert documentation of all ramifications everywhere except in the data as you study it.
I felt that would be your answer, but it's nice to get it down so we can say for sure, no, there isn't.
But you know, I don't know what's happened to the... I do understand Moynihan's got a book coming out soon on family assistance. It talks an awful lot about it. A fellow named with the LA Times, whose name escapes me, was doing a book and interviewed me in depth and Ehrlichman in depth in those days when it's clearly fresher in my mind than it is today. Burke, is that it? And interviewed Nathan extensively, all the working group members. And then he got sick and went in the hospital, and I haven't heard since then. Although I'm having lunch today with Nathan, I'll ask him, what the hell ever happened to that LA Times book on welfare reform?
How are we doing at your
we're
time?
We're fine, anyway. No, we're fine. But on all the other working groups, that which you wouldn't find in the documentation, from an oral history standpoint, there are the players who could tell you an awful lot about it that I, as one person, might not remember. Because as I was running three or four, seldom did three or four have the same composition of any kind. So a Larry Silverman would very well remember, as a Jim Lynn would, what we were doing in terms of that railroad strike legislation. Others on higher education, others on elementary education. So it's pieceable together, I'm confident of that.
We'll find records of your activities then scattered out throughout the files of the domestic council, the central files, the staff secretary for the president, as well as staff secretary for the domestic council, and the various members of these working groups will also have files that will reflect your input and your activities.
I would imagine the earlier files would be up to your ears and what I did.
That would be the source for most of this, would it not?
A lot of them.
Would there be any other source that we should go to in terms of documentation of your activities outside of those that I've named?
I would think we have it from the presidents, Ehrlichmans, and the people involved in those groups, and mine.
Can we get from your secretary, I think, to supplement this meager National Journal material we have that she might have kept in a file for you that we can Xerox it up?
Oh, absolutely. What we plan to do, is go through each file, what goes to central files and index them for you so you know what's there. Rather than do it catch as catch can, we'll go drawer by drawer.
Okay.
If that's all right.
Well, now we have in addition to central files and special files you've been under Robert Gordon Kerline.
Right.
Rather sensitive stuff you really kept
right.
Down here in the central
files. Right. You have my fullest cooperation because I'm one who from the beginning believed it should be done, so we'll do everything we can to help you.
10 years from now, whenever all this material is completed and we've sat down and we've studied it and analyzed it in depth, and we're then ready to come back and talk with you in more depth and with some degree of knowledge about some of these things, where could we reach you?
10 years from now, I'll probably be pumping gas in some little town in Southern California, right? Under the feeder principle, I will have feet. Or working as a dock worker in Panama.
You know, this happened 4 years ago to the Secretary of State of Washington State. Somebody croaked at Lud Cramer. He was reelected, and of course he was reelected this year too. He's a very good vote getter, but to pay off his campaign debts. There's an AP story showing, and photos accompanying showing Lud Cramer pumping gas at some Olympia gas station, emphasizing that he didn't want the big donors to help write his campaign debts off. So it does happen.
No, the honest answer is I have a living mother and a living younger brother. By and large, even the where I was, if I did elect to disappear.
Would you have the name and address of your younger brother just off the top of your head?
Here.
You'll probably always remain a member of some bar association at the state level, won't you? And any of those come to mind, California or?
Arizona.
Bar.
My brother is Tom Morgan. I don't know what transient I am. He's at 6 East Wind, WIND, that's in the Marina in Los Angeles. Apartment 240, Marina Del Rey. For a stable member of the family.
Somehow that sounds almost like a familiar address.
Yeah.
He doesn't have a neighbor, does he?
He is not now, nor was he ever involved in any personal knowledge of.
Seems like CBS had an aerial photo of that.
It's probably is true. Somewhere. It's my mother.
We'll erase that portion of the tape.
Okay. Ruby Morgan, RGB 1, 2555 East Lester, Tucson, Arizona. And she's a secretary at the University of Arizona. I'm sure she'll still be.
You've kind of responded to Ehrlichman in the bulk of the time here, 4 years. How about people that have really been responding to you? Or really work directly or indirectly for you that would help put the puzzle together.
Sure.
Puts all of these reports together.
Well, for openers, you start with Checker Finn, who is now an assistant governor, governor sergeant in Massachusetts. Was a good year or more with me in those days of working groups. Would be an excellent one to talk to. From the civil rights standpoint, certainly Jim Clausen, who is with me now, and I'm not sure will go with me, Treasury. Dan Mead, who's here, and I guess is will stay here. The other two were my assistants who lived upstairs were Evans and Paul, John Evans and Jim Paul.
They will be departing also, will they?
My guess is that, well, I know Evans has announced he's leaving.
Yeah. John Campbell mentioned his name.
Yeah.
Sometime in January.
Paul may be staying.
We can get this lead time on some of these people. You know, we can call them up and say, hey, can we find some time for them to talk?
Right.
That's all we've done. We've done about 40 people as they are ready to move on to something else. In the hopes that the program will interest all of them at some point. Encouraging word in the National Archives here to beef it up so we can do more than just departing people.
Right.
And of course now, in the transition, we're really going to be running back and forth trying to catch people before they do go. But it's also a tender time to go visit somebody.
Particularly some people don't want to go, I'm sure.
Terry went over to General Bob Schultz's last week, and three other guys, they offered us material, which Wilbur carried over and boxed up. So when he walked in with three other guys, it was kind of like to carrying a violin case in the 20s.
What a mansion. Well, in civil rights, you certainly talk to Will Hastings, Jonathan Moore, Stan Plotinger. That would entail more than just civil rights, a lot of the HEW things. Lou Butler, who's now out at, he was at Boulder, Hastings, teaching law, and was just told he's now running some health operation in San Francisco. He was the assistant secretary at HEW for planning and evaluation. That's getting down to the more detail than you want today.
Mm-hmm. Looking back then on your time here.
And George Shultz.
Would it be fair to categorize all of your major responsibility as being civil rights? Would it, am I pushing you on this? And I'm trying to.
Yeah, it wouldn't be civil rights. The last couple of years, it was certainly a heavy emphasis on school desegregation. I got into some other civil rights matters peripherally. But I didn't have the civil rights lead like Len Garman. Obviously, I had the operational lead in school desegregation. But the front of the world on civil rights from the White House was Garman. It would be presumptuous to suggest it was me in civil rights.
Human resources, then.
Human resources is a better term. Which I know that's a broad description, but civil rights, I think, would be one too narrow. And I really didn't get very much involved in the women's amendment, only an advisory thing to Garman once in a while. Nor Indians, would just be helping Garman here and there. But that was Indians were Garman's bag.
This change is really a complete change to function, not only just agency-wise, but functional duty-wise. And it's the kind of thing that Krug was honchoing for a while around here.
That's right.
When you move into that kind of field, law enforcement. Secret Service come under this?
Right. And international trade and tariffs, to the extent that it's very much law-related, that's the exciting part to me, because I am basically an attorney. Besides the management.
And you just really physically operate here until confirmation.
Has anyone been assigned your responsibilities? Is that even a fair question to ask at this point?
It's a fair question to ask, but I guess you'd ask it of Ken Cole. I mean, he's the fair person to ask. He'll be running the place. He hasn't told me one way or the other. I don't know what his plans are.
But some of your stuff may really then go to a successor or functional successor, right, if one designated, otherwise it would just go in the files and rest easy.
All I know is that is when I read the papers, and you get some of the impression that they're going to cut this back by putting, hopefully, some of the people in the departments they won't have to do as much here. I would hope with the right assistant AG and people in HEW, you wouldn't have to have a guy doing civil rights day in and day out. Of the schools like I was.
Well, it certainly is turning loose the whole Ehrlichman people into the agencies and departments, which would be an interesting thing to observe.
You mentioned one or two magazine or newspaper articles, Ed. Are there others that come to mind that you recall as being particularly...
the sample article that I mentioned.
The sample article, yes.
There have been a couple of John Osborne articles in the civil rights area.
Nothing you've written, though, for newspaper or magazine?
No, I took the anonymity question to heart. I didn't write anything for publication. I believed all of them. So, no, I didn't write anything.
Your secretary for most of this time?
For all of the time, so it was Peggy Strzok.
Peggy Strzok.
She's gone back to Phoenix. That was her home. She came here. She has family there.
That's not it. That's touched on all the questions we had prepared. You went in a great deal more depth than I would have expected you to off the top of your head. I'm particularly pleased that you were able to give us all that information. I don't look forward to trying to write a resume of it, though. That's my problem next, Ed.
Well, really, any time I can be of help, I'm just going to be holler. More time, or
it'd be close by.
Right. Busy. Just next door. That's all right. We'll figure it out one way or another.
That's good. Thank you very much.
Thanks too long to explain it, isn't it?